thinking it's so nice to be here. You get to hear the best cast when I get through. Mel and I are a team. I don't know about you, but I just think families should work together. I think the greatest time that Mel and I've ever had is when we do get an opportunity to travel together. We work together in the house every day. We do all of our work from our home. According to PAW, now we're building 2.5 or 3 years ago, we were building a $1.5 million research center. I have not seen it. I do not know where they're building it for us. But I'd be very happy to have it anytime they want to give it to us. But we are in our home at a kitchen table. My work is at the kitchen table, and we have 8 people come into our home from 7:30 in the morning till 6 in the afternoon. If any of you'd like to come and live with these very wealthy people, you can welcome to do that. We have plenty of work for everybody to do. But a few years ago, our oldest son, Jim, came in from school one afternoon, and he said, "Say, Dad," said, what did the framers of the Constitution have in mind when they wrote the Constitution?" He said, "I don't want a long-winded explanation. I want something short and to the point. If you have a 16-year-old, you know exactly what I'm talking about." His dad said, "Well, Jim, I would say just enough centralized government to leave a group of states together, but leave the governing up to the states and its people." He said, "Not in my book." We had never looked at a textbook. I'm ashamed to tell you. You see, I'm just like all of you out there. We had never looked at the textbook. We didn't think we had to. He brought it home the next day, and he had his finger in the place, and he said, "Dad," said, "this book tells me that all the power's in Washington, and I know this is not true." And he opened it, and it had the chapter on the Constitution on the left. It gave the portions of the Constitution. On the right, it attempted to explain it to the students. Throughout the entire chapter, it never told the students that the states retained any rights. It had all the powers on the chapter headings that the federal government assumed, the rights that the states gave up to the federal government, but it never told the students the states had any rights. And he was right. So what did? We did just what most of you would do. We did nothing. We thought that's just one book, right? Okay, but later in the school year, I said, "I'm so glad, and just praise the Lord many times, that God didn't let a 16-year-old give up." He came in from school another afternoon. He had to memorize the Gettysburg Address. The teacher suggested that they go to the encyclopedia and to type it up. We happen to have a 1960 edition of the World Book Encyclopedia, and we don't review encyclopedias. I just want to tell you that now. Don't ask for reviews of encyclopedias. By the way, we have found out, though, that they go just exactly like the textbooks. In other words, they're either changed or before, or they change to correspond with textbooks. So when your textbooks are changed, your encyclopedias usually agree with them. But as he was typing that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, our 60 edition had left out "under God" out of the Gettysburg Address. He came to me and he asked the question. He said, "Mom, I'd like to ask you a question. Now, if my research material is slanted and my textbooks are slanted, where can a young person go to find the truth? What would you do?" We decided to look for the truth. Where do you go? Now, we were very lonely 25 years ago. There was nowhere to go. You have places to go now. That's why we feel such an urgency and a need to be of help and service to you, to try to provide information for you who have nowhere to go for information. We know how lonely it is. Where do you go to find the truth for a young 16-year-old? The only place that we knew was our superintendent of schools. By the way, he happened to be a Christian. He was my husband's Sunday school teacher, and we admired him very much. Mel went to Prof, and he explained Jim's question. And so Prof said, "Well, Mel," he said, "our books are adopted on the state level, and we only get 5 per subject after they've been submitted for adoption. There are anywhere from 13 or more submitted for our adoption. That's where you need to go to get a better textbook." We did not know that. And there's a public hearing for parents. So he said, "You need to go to Austin." Mel came home and he said, "Now, honey, I have to work. You will have to go down to Austin." How many of you moms have heard that? I told you I was just like you were. But see, if God can use me, he can use anybody. I was not a reader. I never read anything. I was a housewife and mother, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I had never traveled by myself in my life. I had not even been to our state capital. And then he told me I had to go. I said, "But what am I going to do when I get there?" And he said, "I don't know, but you can do something." I went down to Austin and I did a lot of things. My husband always would say, "What did you do this time?" It got to be a joke. The boys would say, "Oh, Mother, as soon as we have dinner, would you sit down and tell us what happened this time?" Anywhere I traveled, there was usually things happened. I would get into more problems that I didn't even know I could cause. And you have to realize I'm Irish. And you don't tell an Irishman you're not going to listen to them. I said, they don't know how well off they would have been in Texas had they listened to me and been very gracious to me, because I would not have gone back. I thought I could march down there and, you know, I'd tell them these books were bad. I don't have to go back anymore. But that's not the way it was. I was laughed at. In fact, I was laughed at for 9 years. One of the major publisher's representatives came up to me about 4 or 5 years ago, and he said, "Mrs. Giebler," he had first introduced me to one of his new representatives. This was in one of the hearings in Austin. I noticed that this little young girl kept looking up at me, and I wondered what in the world she was thinking. Finally, she blurted out. She says, "You know, you really are a very nice person." He and I were laughing and talking. He said, "I told you she was. That's why we don't know what to do with her." I smile a lot. Smiles hide a lot of things. If you smile, you can do a lot of thinking. You smile and you certainly tear up the opposition. Try it. You look like you're winning. I don't know about you, but I play to win. You really want to know how to hurt your opposition, go to the school board meetings or any of your meetings. Take you a big, nice, long, yellow scratch pad and a pencil, and hopefully if you're with somebody else, smile and take notes. You don't have to say anything. Smile every now and then. "Just what I wanted to know." One of the publishers said, "Miss Gabler, you totally unnerve me. When you sit there and take notes and smile, you scare me to death." I had not even said anything. Most of the time, I'm just making little old doodles. But you can really hurt your... The other thing I found out is when a major publisher, he's now the president, I won't tell you what company, one of the major companies, asked me not to read from his textbooks. He said, "Ms. Gabler, please, you're not going to read my textbooks before the board today, are you?" I found out that that's exactly how to hurt them. Read from the textbooks. That's why we decided to buy the textbooks and read from them. They always tip you off. But after this young girl, he and I were talking and laughing. He said, "Mrs. Gabler, my colleagues and I had a meeting last night. We had quite a discussion about you." And I said, "I don't doubt that." They meet every November. It's a big meeting. All the publishers are in for the big contracts. Our contracts are large in Texas. This past year, we spent in Texas $93 million just on textbooks. Not on education, textbooks. That's a lot of money. So the contracts are large. And he said, "We were talking about the earlier years when you first started coming to Austin. Do you remember that?" I said, "Oh boy, do I." He said, "We took you as one big joke. We laughed at you every time you stood up." I said, "You laughed at me for 9 years." And then I smiled and I said, "You don't laugh anymore, do you?" He and I were just having a friendly conversation. He said, "No way." He said, that was the rest of our conversation. We decided we'd rather face anybody in the nation than you. You see, they knew we had done our homework and we knew their book. And many times our opposition can't face the truth. And that's the truth. And that's where our problems come today. Our concern has been, as I'm sure yours has, or you wouldn't be concerned with a Christian school or teaching at home, and that is the high rate of illiteracy in this nation. We started keeping a record in 1966. 1966 to 70, ATW showed that 1 million American children, the age of 12 to 17 years, could not read at the fourth grade level. 1971, a Lewis Harris survey showed that 15% of Americans over 16 were functionally illiterate. And 1973, 19 million Americans over 16 were functionally literate. And then from the congressional record from May 1979, We have recent studies indicate that over 23 million adult Americans are functionally illiterate. Another 39 million can barely meet the simple reading demands for daily living. These are people who cannot read a want ad or fill out a job application or comprehend safety signs in the workplace. No estimate can calculate the emotional and economic price exacted by illiteracy. You probably think this is from some dear little conservative in Congress, don't you? Wrong. This is Senator George McGovern, and nobody can call him a conservative. You should get it. It's quite interesting. You'd think that we have tried it. Now, you and I knew this for a long time. Then we found this from last year, from April 1985, from Senator Zirinsky. He said, today, 26 million adult Americans cannot read or write at all. And up to 72 million cannot read or write above the fifth grade level. Adult illiterates are increasing by about $2.3 million a year. In the congressional record by Senator McGovern, according to Judge Charles Phillips of Florida, 80% of the new criminals that passed my desk would not be there if they could read and write. Chief Justice Warren Burger concludes that veteran criminals manifest the same educational pathology. The percentage of inmates in all institutions who cannot read or write is staggering. The rising generation of lawbreakers follows the same pattern. A recent study indicates that 34% of institutionalized juveniles are functionally illiterate. Now, the problem comes, and what happens? If you can't use your mouth, you'll use your fist. That's why you and I are so concerned that our young people learn to read and write. They have intensive phonics and not phony phonics. We call it the look and guess. Well, we had a program that they did learn to look and guess. You had to guess at the words. We had a minister that was preaching down in Houston. He said that look and guess was pretty good when you were young, but as you get older, the words are more difficult. The more you try to guess, the more difficult it becomes. Then you lose the continuity of the article. So you're really guessing. But it doesn't make any difference. We also, from a teacher in one of your nearby states, one of the parents sent it to us just recently. This is from a teacher who had gone to a workshop just recently. This was back in November 85. And it was a new program, you might as well start looking for it, called Inventive Writing. Now that's something I think we'll have to deal with. It said all spelling will be what I refer to as inventive spelling. Each child will read his sentences in a class at a designated time, but there will be no corrections made. I want each child to feel his writing is worthwhile, and it will not be spoiled by red marks. Now, isn't that nice? But the letter went on, and this to me, I hope if you parents get a letter like this, that you will mark it up in red and send it back and say, this is ridiculous. For this reason, the mother who sent it us, she said, no way would I do that for my child, first grade. These papers will be kept by each child in her folder. On Friday, we will staple them together and send them home. Please make a big deal about these papers, even if it doesn't look like much for the first week. If this activity is praised unconditionally every week, I have no doubt that at all that by the end of the year you will see a big difference. I'll bet they will, don't you? She said, remember, this is new to me, too. A typical paper, let me read you what a typical paper will sound like. Would you praise your child for this? A typical first paper might look like this. Monday, August 18, 1985, we, A-R-S-T-R-T-E-N-A-N-U-R-I-T-E-N, P-R-O-G-M, this W-E-C, and we, W-I-L-B-R-I-T-E-N, E-V-R-E-D-A. That kind of paper would be very acceptable and should be praised. Now remember, wouldn't you send it back with red marks? I would. I would not allow my child to have this. Now let me take you through some of the programs to give you a little of an idea of what are they teaching our children. For many years, we used a little library book called The Inner City Mother Goose. How many of you have heard of it? A few. I have news for you. When I reviewed a language grammar program of one of the major publishers here about 2 years ago, we found in the 8th grade book it had poems from The Inner City Mother Goose, and it asked the students to go to the library, get The Inner City Mother Goose, and pattern their poems after it. See if you would want yours patterned after. Jack be nimble, Jack be quick. Snap the blade and give it a flick. Grab the purse, it's easily done. Then just for kicks and just for fun, plunge the knife and cut and run. Christmas is coming, the advertising fat. Please to put a dollar in the old man's hat. Now, if you haven't got a dollar, a half will have to do. If you haven't got a half a buck, then God mug you. Lucy Locket lost her pocket. Kitty Fisher found it. Not a penny was there in it, only ribbon around it. Kitty got mad and cut Lucy up. I have page 8. I'm not going to read page 8 because I just don't use obscene language. And it is. It was interesting, though, because we were in Syracuse, New York, the end of February. And after we finished, there was a reporter came up. And she read the poem and she said, I couldn't print that in my newspaper. Some of the parents said, why not? She said, oh, but we have a code of ethics. They wouldn't let me print that. I said, you mean you don't mind it being printed? You can't print it in the newspaper, but you want our children to have it. That's censorship, isn't it? And she didn't print it in the newspaper. It was interesting. My opposition was not there, but she said that we alleged it was in the books, and she came and read every line herself, but we alleged it. And then she took the opposition, the ACLU, the superintendent, and PAW, People American Way, I don't call them the American Way, and she used them, most of the article was about them, but they were not there. But that's typical of our people. Let me read you another poem. This is high school level. How many of you are good at reading poetry, or even writing it? Do you like poetry? How many of you are real good at writing poetry? Well, I wasn't. I made terrible grades. I wish I had kept them. They're worth money now. Well, somebody bought these. See if you couldn't do this well. I can be alone by myself. This is 10th grade. I can be alone by myself. I was lonely alone. Now I'm lonely with you. Something is wrong. There are flies everywhere I go. I told you. Then would you like to know how it's to be taught? Ask the students to read the poem silently. Shouldn't have even been read the first time. Then ask how the speaker seems to feel. Does he feel sad or alone or discontented? I don't know how you could get that out of there. Have the last 3 lines read aloud again. Something is wrong. There are flies everywhere I go. See, I told you, I don't need jokes even. I can read the publisher's material. Then he said to the guide the direction, you're really not going to believe what they asked the students to discuss. Have the discussion as follows. What do flies usually hang around? Can you just imagine? I don't know. We had 3 boys. Now, I don't know about you, but I'll tell you one thing for sure. I can just imagine how totally out of hand that discussion would become. Especially, we used to live on a farm, and I'm sure it would have become quite a discussion. But that's literature for high school? Now, that's just one of the many ridiculous poems. Here's another one from a different program. This is adopted in our state. We don't win them all. We would like to. Scarlatta Tilt. It's very hard to live in a studio apartment and with a man who's learning to play the violin. That's what she told the police when she handed him the empty revolver. That's it. That's a poem for 10th grade. Now there's a discussion afterwards. Why did she shoot him? B, maybe living in a city had something to do with it. A, how? And the publisher's representative stood up before the State Board of Education after me. We present our paper, and then they have a chance to respond, and then we get a rebuttal. And he said, Mrs. Gabler, the poem didn't say a woman shot a man. Chances are she shot the violin. That's just what the board did. They just groaned. And the chairman says, Mrs. Gabler, you're bound to have a rebuttal to that. He had shocked me, and I could not believe he had made that statement. And I said, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, the only thing I can think of is this. Did you ever know of heard of a police go out to the house if a woman shot a violin? They tell us we brought an awful lot of plaster down in the hearings in Austin. Some of the UPI and the Associated Press both said, Mrs. Gabler, we consider education a hard news story, which used to be nobody wanted to cover education, but we never know what you're going to do. My husband doesn't either. I hate to tell you that. But we've at least had a lot of fun. Here's another one. The only thing I can think of is this. The only reason I like to read it, because it is kind of amusing. The only thing you can think, you don't have to have many words to memorize. You just have to know how many. Sometimes I'm happy, I'm going to read it just like it is, real fast. Sometimes I'm happy, la 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 la. Now, this is still 10th phrase. Another 17 laws, she comes to dumb. Another 17 laws, hey, nonny, nonny. Another 20 laws, the zooby doo, pa poopy doo. This is 10th phrase. Another 17 laws, whack-a-doo. Another 10 laws, shaboom, shaboom. Another 10 laws, 17 laws, she dum de dum. Another 18 laws, tra-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la. Another 10 laws, yay, yay, yay. Some poem to waste a child's time in high school. Then we wonder what's happening to our young people today. Here's another poem that should bother you, called Resume on Suicide. Razors pain you and rivers are damp. Acid stain you and drugs cause cramp. Guns aren't lawful, nooses give. Gas smells awful, you might as well live. A discussion. A, yeah, you might as well live. B, suicide is a bit grim. B, A, now if only I could think of a better way to commit suicide. Well, Gems New Voices, one of the major publishers. I just want to give you some ideas. So many people think they know what's in textbooks until you've read textbooks for 25 years and see the changes. There has been changes, though, made. Whether or not the Gabers did it, we don't know. But there's been changes made. We have on the list, at least on the agenda, and if they haven't taken it off at this board meeting, that one of the Basel readers must be intensive phonics. We won that after a hard battle. They kept my little staff member and I, and by the way, this poor little staff member had never had intensive phonics herself. We became, give us a recall at the time we needed it. I could not believe one time when Mel was reading the official record of the hearings on economics, and I'm not good at economics, but I took on, and I even had to take on the ones who wrote the books. And sometimes it have four publishers. And Mel said, honey, I didn't know you know that. And I said, let me see what I said. When you're in the hearing 7.5 days, I can guarantee you one thing, you're going to look to see what you said. You say a lot of things you wish you hadn't said later, but you get it back. And after 8.5 hours of talking time on the witness stand, I said it was interesting. We had 3.5 hours. We ended up 8.5 hours, and the timekeeper said, Ms. Gabriel, you've still got 23 minutes left. I don't know how we did it, but you see, talking time doesn't come out of the question. By the way, if you're ever in the hearings, I learned that, you know, you can soon learn you're right. One of the state board asked a question. He interrupted me when I was reading my brief, and I said, wait a minute, question. Mr. Chairman, does that come out of my time or yours? Because if it comes out of mine, I'm not giving mine up. I'll ask the questions when I get through, because I'm not going to take it out of my time. And so they learned pretty quick that I wasn't give up my time for questions. that's Irish in you. You can pretty well do it when you when you hold your own. But we must learn as parents to hold our own with those that are in authority. You don't have to be rude, but you do have a right. And I prayed at all times that I would not lose my temper. I don't know about you, but I did. I was fast on the draw, and I could think faster sometimes than I could talk, and I learned to talk pretty fast. And my husband said, I taught him that on the program, especially on the Donahue or any of those programs, you can't even catch your breath or stop for a period or comma if you do. Somebody else has got your place. You have to talk real fast and to get your points across. But it's not always easy in the hearing. And I prayed so much, and those who prayed for us, that we at all times would conduct ourselves as Christians. And what a difference it made. I lived to see the day that one of the board members who was so rude to me, he was vice chairman of the board, and he was a brilliant attorney. And I said, he tried my soul. Have you ever had someone that did that to you? Every time I stood up, I always would see him. He sat right down. I'd have to stand here and sit there. And I finally realized he was trying to find where my boiling point was. He must have known I was Irish. And I prayed just as hard that he wouldn't find that boiling point. They had treated me very rude, so I had filed a complaint and demanded to be reheard because they had violated my civil rights. And I won it. I got to be heard again. But he let me almost get through, and I knew I could tell. You can tell when somebody's getting ready to interrupt you. He finally said, Mrs. Gabler, suppose you tell me and the members of this board just what qualifies you for us to listen to anything you've got to say. Ooh, that's a good one for an Irishman. I don't know about you, but I thought of 100 things I should not have said. And for some unknown reason, I said, yes, sir, I have 3 good reasons. And I smiled, and I said, I'm so glad you asked that question. I wasn't. But I know now that God gave me 3 reasons. I said, please, God, give me 3 good reasons. I had none. I have never been able to find 3 good reasons any better since then. So I know that God gave me the reasons. And you talk very slow, which is not like me. I said, number one, my sons belong to my husband and I. They do not belong to you in the state yet. Number two, as a taxpayer in this state, my money is buying the product. In other words, I'm buying the textbooks. Number three, we elect you to office. Do you have 3 better ones? And he said, case dismissed. It's not always easy. I try to have a little fun in Austin. One of the books that I particularly had a lot of fun that you probably would like to hear, this was a world history book for 9th grade that was submitted for our state's adoption by one of the major publishers. This is one of 4 in a series. Let me show you how they present biblical truth as fallacies to young students. And I'll read the entire paragraph, lest you think I've taken it out of context. We know for sure that Moses did lead the Hebrews out of Egypt. The shortest way was the road along the Mediterranean coast. This led directly to the promised land of Palestine. But there were many Egyptian soldiers along the road, and it was unsafe for the Hebrews. Instead, Moses may have led them across some shallow swamps and into the Sinai Desert. The Hebrews called these swamps the Sea of Reeds, because of the tall grass that grew in them. It may be that the Sea of Reeds was later called the Red Sea by mistake. So Neil said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know, but God will give me something. In the hearings, I said, you know, this author gave God greater credit than he did. Not he couldn't do it. I think he did exactly what he said. He parted the water, the Red Sea, and Moses walked across and his people on dry land. He didn't even say walk across the mud. Did he? Okay. So I said, you know, I said, according to this author, I said, Pharaoh's entire army, his horses, his men, the chariots, and everything completely drowned and disappeared in a swamp. Now that's a miracle. That is a miracle. The book wasn't taken in Texas, I thought you might like to know. To show you in almost any area for third grade, second and third grade, jump rope jingles and other useful rhymes. This is one of the books we found in West Virginia during the height of their problem. They see the beautiful little baby crying. Would you like to know what you can jump rope to for a child? Fudge, fudge, call the judge. Mama's got a newborn baby. It's not a girl and it's not a boy. It's just a newborn baby. Wrap it up in tissue paper. Put it on the elevator. 1, 2, 3, and out she goes. Textbook. I don't honestly believe that moms and dads really know what are they teaching your children. I really don't believe you really know that. What I'm more afraid than textbooks, and it's something that we all go through next in the time that we have, and you could spend days trying to decide what might be of the most value to you. You must be very careful whether you're in a public school, teaching at home, or a Christian school. They're not all the same. Be very careful of who's in charge of the school, what philosophy they hold, what programs they allow. Also, be very careful about the teachers that you hire, or even the material that you use in your homeschooling. It's extremely important. Don't ever take anything for granted. Take a look at it yourself. You certainly know right from wrong, but I'll tell you one thing. If I had a degree, I might not. And my sons hold degrees. And I have a lot of friends that have degrees. But the reason I say that, you will never know how many top officials in our state and in your state that do not know right from wrong. I sat for an hour and a half in Brisbane, Australia. They literally tried to crucify me. And most of it was, Mrs. Gabler, how do you know right from wrong? I said, my dog knows right from wrong. If I can teach a dog, I can teach a child. But I said, more than anything else, God tells me what's right or wrong. You see, you and I as Christians have a norm. If you're a humanist, you have no norm of right or wrong. It's whatever is right at the time, and that makes a difference. But they literally don't know right from wrong. Mel was asked this recently by three superintendents. Mr. Gabler, how do you know right from wrong? I don't know about you, but I don't have a problem. If you don't know right from wrong, you'd better learn fast. Because there is a right or wrong. But where's all the gray area? How many of you have heard that? No gray area. God says it's either right or wrong. There's no in between. There's no gray area. And they know it. I want to bring one more thing to you, I guess because the story so touched my heart. Speaking in Kanawha County in West Virginia, a little 16-year-old girl one evening during the question and answer raised her hand and says, Mrs. Gabler, have you ever listened to the cassette tapes that are played in the classroom? I said, no. She said, 2 weeks ago for English literature, for a week, we had to listen to a tape and then go over and over a story called The Diary of a Madman. She said, I still hear the screaming, and I've not been able to sleep. I thought, what could disturb a 16-year-old to that point? When we arrived home, we ordered fictional diaries, a part of a big series from one of the major publishers. We also ordered the tape. It's about it's a diary being kept by a very prominent judge in France who kept a diary about killing people and the thrill of killing. Can you now put yourself in the eyes of a young 16-year-old when you hear these words? I'll only read you part of it. August the 25th, I must kill a man. I must. August the 30th, it is done. But what a little thing, I had gone for a walk in the forest of Vernes. I was thinking of nothing, literally nothing. See a little child on the road.
a little child eating a slice of bread and butter, and he stops to see me pass. He says, "Good day, Mr. President." The thought enters my head, shall I kill him? "You are alone, my boy?" "Yes, sir." "All alone in the woods?" "Yes, sir." The wish to kill him intoxicated me like wine. I approached Lee quite softly, persuaded that he was going to run away. And suddenly, I seized him by the throat. He held my wrist in his little hands, and his body writhed like a feather on the fire. Then he moved no more. I threw the body in the ditch and some weeds on top of it. I returned home, and I dined well. What a little thing it was. In the evening, I was very gay, light, rejuvenated, and passed the evening at the local bar. They found me witty, but I have not seen blood. I am not tranquil. As the diary went on, the parents came in to him, and they wept. He talked about how it wept and how he enjoyed seeing it. And then he came to a fisherman that was fishing. He took a shovel and he killed him. He got the blood he was looking for. And then the nephew of the man that he had killed was brought into him to be sentenced. January the 25th, to death, to death, to death. I have had him condemned to death. The Advocate General spoke like an angel. Ah, yet another. I shall go see him executed. March the 10th, it is done. They guillotined him this morning. He died very well. That gave me pleasure. How fine it is to see a man's head cut off. Mel listened to the tape. He said, "Honey, it's not worth it." I agree with the little girl. The screaming haunts you. You realize that even on television, or if you see things outside of a classroom situation, you can turn it off, but you can't turn off a classroom experience. When you're forced to sit and listen to a man kill, we have to ask the question, is that education or indoctrination? I happen to believe we have something better to offer our young people. I have a real love for young people. We are the parents of 3 sons. We now have 6 grandchildren. Our grandchildren are reading the books that started out reviewing for our oldest children. And we happen to have a love for children, or we wouldn't do what we're doing. We travel so much. You saw our schedule, you'd wonder how we kept up with it. Pray for us. We need your prayers. And I'll share with you before mail comes what our oldest son, who made a speaking engagement in the D.C. area, asked him to keep some little notes on how we could help ourselves to benefit because we were not professional speakers. And if you don't want that information, don't ask your children. They're happy to give you that information. Jim kept his little note, and on the way back home, he said, he told his dad some of the things that he considered might be a little improvement. I said, "Oh, what about your mom?" He said, "Mom, for the life of me, I don't understand. You're at home, you're so slap happy. You get up to speak, it's different." He said, "You know, I'm convinced of one thing, that God gave you the mouth and Dad the brains." Like you to meet the brains.
What are they teaching your children? What are they teaching our children? That's the title of this conference. That's also the title of our newest book. So if Norma has stirred your interest or you have some questions, this book is a condensation of our 24 years of experience. In this book, we've tried to help you as parents so you don't have to go through the same knockdowns, same embarrassing situations that we did. 2 chapters tell you what you can do. Now, Norma's speaking, and part of mine will be primarily for those in public school, and I presume that in this audience, very few of you have your children in public school. But it still applies because a large percentage of Christian schools are using secular textbooks. And if they are, unless the teacher is making up for it, Those schools are indoctrinating their students with the very philosophy their school was formed to counteract. This is sad. Let me give you some examples of what we find in textbooks. There are two maps. The top map is correct. The bottom map is not. There are 14 errors between the top map and the bottom map from World Geography, I believe it was last year. Of those 14 errors, 13 are either favorable to Marxist countries or unfavorable to free world countries. And you think that the books that go to the students are perfect, like we used to think down the last period and comma? A couple of years ago, we turned in what our state calls bills of particulars. We must list by page, line, and paragraph specific portions of the text about which we want to make objections or comments or take up for the books. And we had in our bill of particulars many listings of errors, errors of fact, distortions of fact, contradictions, so forth. This particular publisher acknowledged that we were correct in enough places that it takes an entire page just to list the page references. That book was ready for the teachers to use to misteach the students. Now, in the recent years, our time has been cut down so sharply that we don't have time for a long presentation. So what we've gone to is charts. Now, these bar graphs should all be 100% just to meet our state requirements. Not a Christian or a moral criteria, just to meet our state's requirements. You can see the books are very, very deficient. Yet this is the way the books were submitted to our state. So you say, well, after all, that's just the Gablers. I have in my hand here an official report of the U.S. Department of Education. This report came out last July. In this report, a lengthy report, the head reviewer was Dr. Vitz from New York University, a psychologist. He had other reviewers helping him. In their study, they found many things. They found that in 40 social studies texts, grades 1 through 4, not one of those 40 mentioned contemporary religion, in spite of the fact that 74% of Americans consider themselves religious. Then, in the Basel Readers, he points out several things. References to Christianity or Judaism are uncommon and typically superficial. In particular, Protestantism is almost entirely excluded. Patriotism is close to non-existent. And his report summarizes in three lines what they found with the readers. Quote, "The above characteristics taken together make it clear that these Basel readers are so written as to represent a systematic denial of the history, heritage, beliefs, and values of a large segment of the American people." That's a U.S. Department of Education report. Before that, Georgetown University's Public Policy Center published two books, one of them on American government, the other one on the five most popular high school history texts in the United States. And they examined these five high school history texts on the basis of how they treated the Cold War in those texts. Strangely, in those texts, the United States wore the black hat, the Soviet Union the white hat. Then one of the books that was adopted in our state, which is getting adopted all over the nation, it's well written, interesting, so forth, but it's the most politically biased book that we have ever seen. In this particular book, President Reagan personally is blamed for the entire increase of the national debt since 1981. It's so blatant that one of the liberal Democrats on our state board of education said, this is nothing but a hatchet job on the president, and I'm not a friend of the president. Also, this text says that the United States is to blame for the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and the Cold War. Not the aggressor nation, but the United States. Now, we're in a battle, a spiritual battle. We have many verses that would apply to this, but I think the one that most clearly delineates the problem is in Romans 2. And be not conformed to this world. This is speaking to Christians. Be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that ye may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. This describes what I call functional humanists. Maybe they are Christians. Maybe they're just professing Christians. But even though they're born again, they're still operating in a humanistic framework. We have the same situation in our country that is true in South Korea. In South Korea, 34% of the people profess to be born again. Many of them converted from Buddhism. They operate in a Buddhist culture, an alien culture as far as Christianity is concerned. Makes it difficult for them. Same thing is true here, but too often, as Christians, we do not realize this. This is why we can have Christian teachers who use very humanistic books and cannot see it, because they've been indoctrinated through in-service training programs, teacher training institutes, and so forth. That's all they've heard year after year after year. What we need in Christian schools is curriculum based on biblical principles, and then we add thereto. And praise the Lord, there's a lot of effort that has been made and is being made in this direction. So when you select material either for your home school, for a Christian school, be careful. Now, we can help you a great deal. We have a number of different handbooks, and our handbooks consist of the most pertinent articles from our research file covering the area about which the handbook pertains itself. For instance, either death education, drug education, phonics, creationism, or whatever. And we try to keep these books up to date. That's why we can't have them printed. One of them is acceptable textbooks. So anybody that knows of any books that should be on our list that's not on there, please let us know about them. Please. Every time I'm on a secular program, I challenge the audience to give me the names of any textbooks which still teach traditional, basic American values, absolute values. See, the problem we have is that the textbooks, now I could include others such as curriculum, teachers, programs, films, and so forth, but we work only on textbooks, and we do not work on library books. But in the textbooks, what we find that they are based on the assumption that humanism is neutral. You might be better to use the term secularism, because humanism become a trigger word. But actually, the humanists have their own Bible. Now, that's a small b and in quotes. This is the Bible of the humanists. Manifestos 1 and 2. What we have done to make our case is to take the 9 doctrines of their manifesto, which are prevalent in textbooks, and on the left side of the page listed what the manifestos call for, what they advocate, what they want taught, and then on the right side of the page quotes from textbooks to show the textbooks are doing exactly what they want. So whether a teacher, administrator, parent, or anyone else says, well, I'm not a humanist, I don't see any humanist about that book, was the books are following their manifesto, their Bible, quote-unquote, small b, they are teaching the religion of secular humanism, and they advocate that their people must be just as fervent in promoting their humanistic values as the most Bible-thumping fundamentalists. Now, the 9 areas which we find prevalent in textbooks are evolution as though it were fact. That's the first one, evolution, with no doubt that that's the only possible explanation for life. The second one is individual autonomy, or self-awareness, or as Christian we would say self-righteousness. Just the opposite of the scripture. The third one, and to me this is probably the most dangerous, and this is a matter of relativism, situation ethics, that each student must decide for him or herself whether an action is right or wrong, depending on the circumstances. The next one, we call distorted realism. That's where the humanists brag. They've already won the battle for the library books, public schools. The next one is sexual permissiveness, and this is why you see so much push for sex ed courses. But if you stop to look, CECUS, Planned Parenthood, and other sexologies have been pushing for sex ed in every school in the nation for years. Do you know how many states mandate sex ed statewide? 7. You didn't know we'd done as well as we had. This doesn't mean individual schools don't teach it, but this means they have not nearly won the battle like they had hoped to by this time. Another one is a bias against biblical values, bias against Christianity. Now, it's strange in the textbooks. They can promote Zen Buddhism. They can have the students play act being a Hindu. Students taking the part of the caste system, and for several days actually participate being a Hindu. The same people that do not want the Bible, do not want Christianity, can see nothing wrong with that. And when you get to sex ed and we point out that those courses are always, almost always taught without any morality, we're immediately told, oh, but you can't add morals or else you'd be teaching religion, and religion is a violation. Separation of church and state. And that, of course, is a totally false issue, because the First Amendment guarantees us that there will be no restriction on religion. Therefore, if a teacher will not allow the Bible in a classroom or a prayer, she or he is violating the Constitution. But for too many years, we've let the ACLU-type lawyers push this idea of separation of church and state. For instance, in our city, when our board voted to eliminate Gideon Bibles and eliminate prayer, the pastor of the largest church, he applauded it. He says, we want to be law-abiding people, and it's against the law to have the Bible in a classroom. But that's not the supreme law of the land. The supreme law of the land, the same thing applies in many, many parental rights. We have a handbook of nothing but court rulings which are favorable to parents. Now, if you talk about humanism, what do they think about this battle? Here's a quote from one of their own publications. The fundamentalists are right. Secular humanism does dominate America. Those who strenuously oppose secular humanism actually wish to repeal the modern world in insisting that America return to its Judeo-Christian biblical traditions. They ignore our philosophic, scientific, and aesthetic sources of inspiration. Now, in the time left, I'd like to go over those 9 doctrines of humanism. The first one, as I said, was evolution. Evolution as though it were fact. I have a chart here called Evolution, Fact, and Faith. Those in the front can probably see there's a green tree which represents primitive life branching out to worms and starfish and goats and birds and snakes, etc. But at the tip of these limbs, there's a little small represents the oldest known fossils for these various life forms. Everyone without exception, the oldest one is as complex, as thorough, as complete as the modern day life form of whatever species it is. Does that look like evolution? Now, this is evolutionary evidence. Also, no intermediate forms. No intermediate forms. But one of the things the children are always told, that all scientists are evolutionists. Would you like to know that there's some world famous scientists who are either creationists, reluctant creationists, or non-evolutionists, who say the scientific evidence is preponderously against evolution? For instance, Sir Fred Hoyle, he's an astronomer. He invented drew up the steady state theory of the origin of the universe. You know what he says? Quote, the chance that higher life forms might have emerged through evolutionary processes is comparable with the assembling of a Boeing 747 from a tornado sweeping through a junkyard. His associate is an Indian from India, Chandra Wickram Singhi. He's a Buddhist. And he said that here was the evidence against evolution for creation, but my most greatest problem was accepting this in view of my agnostic Buddhist background. So he said, my religion stood in the way. But he said, the evidence is against evolution for creation. Dr. Colin Patterson said that for over 20 years, he had been teaching evolution. He wrote a book on evolution. He's a world authority on cladistics. But he said one morning he woke up and said, what evidence do I have? What evidence do I have? So he started speaking to evolutionary groups and asking the same thing. Here in Chicago, he spoke to the Field Museum of Natural History. He asked the question, in the question and answer period after he spoke, tell me one thing you know about evolution. Dead silence. Then he spoke at the University of Chicago, and do you know what answer he got there? At first, dead silence, and then someone spoke up and said, there's only one thing I know. It should never be taught in high school. Yet we find it in elementary grades, middle school, as well as high school. To show you how they do teach in the textbooks, quote, infants can grasp an object such as a finger so strongly that they can be lifted into the air. We suspect this reflex is left over from an earlier stage in human evolution when babies had to cling to their ape-like mother's coats while mothers were climbing or searching for food. Now that is an example. You say, well, evolution, we're already convinced. I can go through the entire 9 points and make just as strong a case on them. But we have had enough of these on our table in the back right next to our book, and these are free. If you haven't gotten one, pick it up. In those 9 areas, we have quoted on the left side of the page from the manifesto, on the right, quotes from textbooks. The matter of situation ethics is something that's very serious. For instance, here is a second grade book which says such things as abstract words such as right and wrong should never be taught. No one would think of teaching the meanings of these words, right and wrong. Also in this particular book, children are studying about the boy who cried wolf, and in the teacher's edition, says a moral has been purposely omitted in order that the children, when reading the story, can come to their own moral conclusions. I asked you, how many second grade children need guidance? How many do not? But it's not only in the area of moral values. This situation ethics moves over into the area of grammar. I have a language grammar book. And in this language grammar book, the children are studying about Billy Goat Gruff. And I'm reading from the teacher's edition. Quote, do not... excuse me. Do not correct the grammar that you hear in the children's statements. Instead, listen for individual differences. And we have several, write them on the chalkboard, and it gives 2 examples. 1, the bottom goat is more bigger than the middle goat. 2, the bottom goat is bigger than the middle goat. And the teacher's edition continues. Explain that people talk and write in different ways and that these sentences are an example. You should not suggest that either example is right or wrong. And it continues. Do not insist on correct answers to these questions. The questions are more valuable than the answers. That's first grade. Let me show you what the third grade does. And this is, again, teaching grammar. And these kind of books were used in our state 10 full years. Quote, and this is my last. You should not worry young children about grammar and spelling. Suggestions of this type always tend to be inhibiting. Young children have many years of reading during which to be exposed to standard grammar and spelling. They will gradually learn to eliminate these errors anyway. Now, are you paying tax money for that type of education if your children are still in the public school and if your children are in the Christian school? Have you looked? And where we can help you is the fact that we have thousands of reviews of textbooks like this in great detail. They may be 20, 30, 40, 50 pages long, in which we list page, line, and paragraph, quote from the book, and give our reason for commenting. Now, you may not agree with a single one of our comments, but if you will take our review, go through this textbook it covers, in 20 or 30 minutes, you'll know where the mind of the child is being directed. Whereas if you start from scratch to review that same book, you better allow about 2 weeks, because the books are written so realistic, so natural sounding, so convincing, that we all tend to take them at face value. But where you find the mind of the child is being directed is when you go through that book line by line. Thank you for being such an attentive audience. Thank you.